GQ's Mad Influence is presented by Moët & Chandon. Life's memorable moments must be Moët & Chandon. Welcome to Mad Influence. I'm your host, Jim Nelson, editor-in-chief of GQ. Mad Influence is a podcast about artistic breakthroughs and what I like to call the long arc of creativity. My next guest fits that to a T, in a very short amount of time, actually. Damien Chazelle, who is still just 33 years young, has become one of the most critically acclaimed directors working in Hollywood. It probably doesn't seem like a short time for him. He certainly put in his time, took on writing projects to pay the bills early in his career, stuff that would sell, as he puts it, before writing and directing an 18-minute version of the film that would become Whiplash. It seems since those 18 minutes, he's made every minute count. That short allowed him to get funding to make the 2014 feature film version of Whiplash about a young drummer played by Miles Teller and his tyrannical chair-hurling instructor played by J.K. Simmons, who won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar for his performance. The film was also nominated for Best Picture. Chazelle followed that up with a bold assertion of style and ambition. La La Land, a musical, a form that every few years people love to pronounce dead. La La Land became one of the most successful musicals of all time and earned a suite of Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Actor Ryan Gosling. Emma Stone won for Best Actress, and Chazelle himself won Best Director, the youngest ever.
Good to see you.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Hey, how are you?
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Good to see
you again.
Hello.
He's following that up this year with a mildly ambitious movie about landing on the moon. First Man recounts how Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and a generation of astronauts explored the outer limits of human flight, culminating in the Apollo 11 mission that landed on the moon. It pairs him again with Ryan Gosling, who plays Armstrong. The movie is out October 12th and continues Chazelle's remarkable streak.
All right, awesome. Should we just start this?
Yeah, let's just jump right into it if you want to have a seat here.
Damien Chazelle, welcome to Mad Influence.
Thank you.
So since this is a podcast about the creative process and the influence that come to bear on creative breakthroughs, I wanted to reach back for a second and ask you about your earliest interest and awareness of film. I've read that you were interested in becoming a director from an ungodly early age. Were you just a child film buff, or were you seriously making movies, and how did that manifest itself, that early obsession?
Well, I think I definitely wanted to make movies before I knew what making them really entailed. So I think long before I knew what a director was, I knew I wanted to do whatever that was, to sort of somehow be responsible for the images that I was seeing on screen. But most of those images when I was young were animated images. They were, cartoons and a lot of Disney movies. So I think my first way into movies was drawing and sort of imagining myself as an animator. I think I wanted to be Walt Disney, basically,
yeah, really?
before anything else. I think early on, once I was old enough to be watching live action movies, for instance, I for whatever reason, really gravitated towards thrillers and murder mysteries and action movies. And so I think, that kind of tipped my mom off to, okay, well, maybe she was a bit of a cinephile herself. Maybe I can get him to watch some older versions of those same movies, if he's obsessed with The Fugitive, maybe which I'm still obsessed with to this day.
The movie or the series?
Well, the movie, which came out when I was young and
That's
impressionable.
A great movie. It holds up too.
But maybe I can lead him to Hitchcock's The Wrong Man or North by Northwest or these sort of predecessors. And so I became obsessed with Hitchcock. So I think some of it was just stuff I kind of found on my own. Some of it was definitely deliberate, careful plotting by my my parents or various people around me. I remember the first time my French uncle, gave me this sort of very impressive looking box set, kind of a collector's edition he had of Citizen Kane. Mm. It was the first time I'd ever heard of Citizen Kane, but it was like, oh, well, any movie that's important enough to get a box set like this, it was gigantic.
Got to be good.
And it didn't have any images on it. It was just the giant lettering, that kind of iconic font, Citizen Kane. It sounded like, the Ten Commandments. It seemed like something that was like delivered from on high. And so I had to watch that and then rewatch it. And so it kind of snowballed in that way, till I was watching sort of a little bit of everything, I guess.
And that whole time, it seems like even from when you were a child, you had these sort of twin obsessions, right? It was music and film, right?
I didn't have really a choice but become completely immersed in music once I was in high school, and I was in a, wound up kind of somehow getting a spot that I still think was probably by mistake in this sort of elite competitive jazz ensemble, and that would kind of travel around the country and around the world and play concerts and competitions, and was led by a very terrifying band leader. And so I think just in order to survive in that ensemble, I kind of had to drop everything that wasn't jazz and drums for a good 4 years of my life.
Yeah. I was rewatching Whiplash, and I was thinking about how that reflects, at least in part, your learning, wanting to make music, wanting to become not just adept, but professional, right? Mm-hmm. And at some point, you decided to just throw all your energies into filmmaking. So I'm wondering what swayed you or finally convinced you? Was it figuring out you were better suited to one? Was it tyrannical teachers? Was it a combination?
No, I think that the tyrannical teacher in my case motivated me to do more music than I would have ever done, I think, because I think movies were still just this, that was the siren song for me from the get-go and probably still throughout. But again, I'd say I was scared into practicing my head off and into really sort of trying to become a jazz drummer. But I think I always had a sense that I wasn't really, the process of becoming a jazz drummer was difficult and scary in part because I wasn't a jazz drummer. It wasn't really at my root what I was. I for whatever reason, I didn't feel like I had the you know, God-given gift or whatever it is that that separates, you know, the Chick Webbs and the Sid Catlets and the Philly Joe Jones from everyone else. If I was really honest with myself, I think I knew that, you know, sure, maybe drumming could be an interesting avenue for a certain period of time, but I didn't want to do something that I didn't feel like I really had something to offer, and I didn't feel like I had much to offer in jazz drumming. That the best I would ever get would be to play really well, but not really to advance the art form or to have any ideas of my own. And so it just, yeah.
When you made the short of Whiplash, I have not seen the 18-minute version, and I'm wondering if J.K. Simmons is in that.
Yeah.
And what was
yeah, he is.
What brought you to him? How did you know he was the right guy to play a chair hurling instructor?
To be honest, I didn't know. I had written this role of this band leader very much with my own band leader in mind, who looked nothing like J.K. Simmons. Was very much a sort of an Italian-American, New Jersey, that's where I grew up, type. Much more someone who would belong in The Sopranos than who would belong, you know, anywhere you'd find J.K. Simmons. And so when it was actually Jason Reitman, who had worked with J.K. a lot, you know, asked me what I thought of him for the role, my immediate response was, I think he's a great actor. I don't think, but I'm not sure he's this role. Mm. And I'll always remember the first day of actually shooting with J.K. It's a scene in the movie where he, as he often does in the movie, explodes.
You cannot fucking read tempo? Can you even read music? What the fuck is this?
It's a half note.
What is this?
It's a dotted 16.
Sight read this measure.
Bop, 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 bop,
whoa, whoa, are you in a fucking a cappella group? Play the goddamn set! Stop! Now answer my question. Were you rushing or were you dragging? Answer me!
And he exploded in such a way that you could just feel, you could feel it. Whatever it is, you could feel it. Like everyone went quiet, everyone got deathly afraid. There was sort of a chill that descended on the entire room. He just had a way of completely owning this space that we'd carved out for this scene. And just seeing the rushes, seeing the dailies come in from that short and putting the short together quickly in the editing room, I very quickly went from, you know, not entirely sure whether he fit the role to feeling that no one else could fit the role.
So So can you tell me the moment, do you remember the moment when the idea of doing La La Land or maybe just the idea of even directing a musical set in L.A. first gained purchase in your mind? And why and how did it capture your imagination?
Yeah, it was, well, I my first feature was a musical when I was kind of, it was basically my thesis film out of college. And, well, I guess I felt like there was still more for me to explore in the genre. It kind of, you know, kind of gave me my first taste of the genre in a way that I found really intoxicating. And especially this idea that we tried to play with in La La Land of you know, can you take the old-fashioned version of the musical genre, really the sort of golden age version of it, you know, what we associate with the 30s, 40s, 50s Hollywood studio musicals, and set it in a modern city with a contemporary relationship and kind of let it butt up against a more sort of documentary reality of what that's like.
There's a scene in that movie where Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling come out of a party and they start hitting their alarms.
Yeah.
And to me, that's when everything lights up in that movie. It's just, it's an incredible scene. Did you imagine that? Was it the first flush of an idea that came to you when you were thinking of LA, or was it the scene where everyone sort of breaks out and dance on the highways? Was there a gateway to what it became?
No, I think if anything, the only scene in La La Land that I'd say kind of preceded La La Land, in the sense that it was kind of a scene in my mind before the rest of the story had been cracked, was the planetarium sequence where they sort of essentially lift off into space. I think everything else very organically, very slowly in many cases, sort of developed around that. And then also, you know, especially with a scene like the sort of search for the cars, that scene especially changed a lot around the actors, around Ryan and Emma when they sort of came on board. A scene that had been kind of in rough shape for years before on the page wound up having to adapt to the characters that had been adapted to them. And then they in turn, I mean, we wanted the whole movie to have a kind of almost improvisational feel to it, you know, so that it wouldn't be the sort of straitjacketed, stylistic kind of vehicle, that it would be something that they as actors and their characters could really drive. And so, you know, I think, you know, from specific lines they say to the idea of kind of using the clicker for the cars as a device to the exact lead up to the song and then the lyrics themselves of the song and the style of it. I mean, all this stuff wound up changing from what it used to be pre-Ryan and Emma to what it became with them. So it became a very collaborative process. Made for two. What a shame. Two are you and me. Some other girl and guy would love this swirling sky, but there's only you and I, and we've got no shot. So I want to ask you about First Man. It couldn't be, in some ways it couldn't be more different in style and ambition. And I've been impressed by how different each of your movies is, both subject-wise and stylistically, to the point where some people might say, oh, what ties it all together? And I don't know that there's any one thing, but I do think that one thing that runs through them all is these are movies about drive and ambition, and they reflect your drive and your ambition to take on something big, to climb and to master it. It's like that scene when Andrew in Whiplash says, I want to be great. I want to be one of the greats. He's breaking up with a girlfriend. Yeah, when he's being a total asshole.
Yes. But do you see any truth to that, that these are movies about drive and ambition?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think you know, timing, I think, had a lot to do with it. I was first given this book, First Man, by Jim Hansen, about Neil Armstrong, right around the time that I had returned from Sundance, where I'd premiered Whiplash. So I think Whiplash especially was still, you know, I had just recently finished it. I mean, we finished it right before Sundance, so it was still swimming in my head. And so I think it couldn't help but, in a way, dictate the prism through which I read Jim Hansen's book. And so I think something that before Whiplash maybe had seemed very remote from me, removed from me, the moon landing, Neil Armstrong, the mythology of all of that, wasn't something that particularly spoke to me. Suddenly, I think, seemed a lot more, you know, up close and personal. It felt like there was a way to take a similar tack with that program, turn a story about, you know, space travel into really a story about failure and rising up through failure and trying to learn from failure and kind of Neil's, you know, famous line that we sort of quote in the movie, failing down here so we don't fail up there.
Yeah.
This idea of kind of pushing against the limits of human potential and trying to kind of push past what humans are supposed or not supposed to do. It felt like actually in many ways there was no clearer distillation of that in history than the moon landing, than, you know, this idea of human beings breaking free from Earth orbit, not just from gravity, but from Earth orbit itself, flinging themselves further physically from the Earth than ever before in history or ever since. And landing on another celestial body and walking around as though they belong there, which they, you know, they clearly don't. I mean, it's such a breaking and a transgression of everything it seems like the natural world is telling humans to do. Stay in your box, stay on the ground, stay here. Everything is conspiring to tell you that this is an insane idea. And I think we forget, 50 years hence, we forget that. I think we actually, because it was so successful, we almost think of the moon as part of our own little, you know, fiefdom now, right, in a way, because we've walked on it, because it has footprints on it. But before 1969, there were not only no footprints on it, but the very idea of it was inherently fantastical and inherently just not what us mere mortals are supposed to do.
Yeah.
And so I think thinking about how you wrestle violently at times something fantastical like that into reality, and how you turn a dream into something concrete and tangible, and how difficult and violent and bloody and sweaty and costly that endeavor can be, all of that suddenly spoke to me in a much louder way, I think, than it ever had before.
There's the movie has this incredible balance, I think, is really hard to find, between intimacy and exterior ambition. And there's I would think, if anything, it'd be quite possible to get lost in the technical geekery of it all.
Mm-hmm.
How did you solve that?
I think I really, almost more than anything, have to credit Ryan with that, and as well as Claire. Mm-hmm. Ryan, as soon as we had a script to give to Ryan, it was something that I think Ryan helped push us on, mm-hmm, every step of the way to not let the technical overwhelm the personal, and to not let Ryan had the first meeting I had with Ryan after him having read the script, he was full of ideas, as he often is. It's sort of what I love about him as an actor. He's just a fount of ideas and inspiration, and always wants to experiment and try stuff, and he'll change his mind about stuff, but it doesn't matter. It's just like it's just constantly energizing. And he came in and said, this movie is about the moon and the kitchen sink. And in my mind, the movie was sort of, as I was describing, almost a la Whiplash, was kind of a mission movie. It was here's the goal, and we're going to do it, and we're going to show how hard this was. But in his mind, it was about more than that. It was actually about the texture of daily life that an astronaut family at that time would go through. And how do you find this balance between this kind of ridiculously grand cosmic endeavor that you're a part of, with needing to clean the pool and take out the trash and you know, be a husband and a wife, be a mom and a dad, like raise kids, have a family, and to root everything in that, to sort of constantly be mindful of that contradiction, that juxtaposition. That's what fascinated him. It's what in turn started to really fascinate me even more than the mission itself, and it kind of became a mantra for us.
Well, there's an interesting stylistic choice you made, which is you don't really see, everything is almost told through the prism of the astronauts, and there isn't, usually in space films you're used to seeing like giant rocket takeoffs and, you know, the launchers, and it is much more, there's almost a claustrophobia at times to it, because when they go into the space vessels there, it's incredibly cramped and you feel that cramped quality. But was that a conscious decision not to externalize it, but to sort of keep it all grounded from the astronaut's prism?
I think it was a sort of built-in irony that I found pretty juicy, which is that, you know, nothing's more infinite than space, the expanse of space, and nothing is tinier than these capsules.
Yeah.
They are literally tin cans, I think it was something I felt like I hadn't seen in a film before was it's very difficult to communicate scale of any kind through cinema. It's just sort of a difficult thing. It's one thing to kind of see up close in real life one of these capsules, or to crawl into them or a replica of them. You immediately feel the tininess, the claustrophobia, the discomfort of it. But how can we make the audience really feel the tininess of these capsules and really feel that kind of juxtaposition between how terrifyingly vast space feels like, how terrifyingly huge, for example, the Saturn rocket is. I mean, this thing is taller than the Statue of Liberty. It's taller than Big Ben. This was a high rise of a rocket. It's essentially a missile that, you know, that you're then strapping three human beings on top of with the purpose of hurtling them into outer space. How can we communicate these things in a way that you just feel on a gut level, so you don't have to be told as an audience member, well, this is this high and this is this small? And that was the intention, that was the effort, was to film in such a way, often film with very small cameras. That's why we filmed a lot of it, you know, everything inside the capsule on Super 16 millimeter. So we could kind of, you know, you could pan from one person to another. You could do true POV angles. You could go wide angle on a very small camera and really feel the surroundings. So I really wanted to make sure we were aware, the way you are in a movie about someone being buried in a coffin. You know, mm-hmm. you look at certain famous buried alive kind of scenes. You feel the top of the coffin. You feel the edge of the coffin. You have a sense a little bit of what that space is. And it felt like if we could accomplish that with these capsules and really tie the individuals to their space so that the environment and the individual were always one and the same, that you as an audience member could feel like, wow, I'm in there with them and I'm scared.
Yeah. There's a scene in it, I think it's Gemini 8, when they lose control of the vessel and it starts rotating madly.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe that I could I've seen lots of movies with much simpler plot lines and I don't know where I am. And yet I know exactly where I am. I know I'm hurling in space. I know how I'm hurling.
Mm.
That's an incredible accomplishment just on a logistical orientation point of view.
Thanks. I guess the only thing I'd say there that you know, helped us was sort of this, again, kind of going back to this self-imposed limitation of only seeing what cameras could actually see.
Right.
So there's no camera, you know, hovering out, you know, in the middle of space, filming from afar, you know, for example, the Gemini capsule spinning. But there is, and there's actually, you know, terrifyingly, you know, actual archival footage you can find of this. There was a camera mounted on the side of the craft. We simulate that exact angle, showing you that view of a spin. And then, of course, other than that angle, we more or less, with a few exceptions, restrict ourselves to what the astronauts themselves could see. So through the window inside the capsule. So I think in a weird way, by limiting ourselves in that sense, it didn't make shooting very fun because shooting in very tight spaces, it can drive you up the wall. But you're limiting your choices in such a way that even kind of a complicated technical sort of situation like that can be reduced to its essentials.
Hey, I want to take a quick break here to thank Moët & Chandon. As you know, because you've been listening, Mad Influence features personalities and performers who shape our culture, focusing on moments that have mattered most to them. We explore artistic breakthroughs and hard-won discoveries that have helped forge legacies and define careers. The stuff, in other words, that's worth celebrating. So it's fitting that this season of Mad Influence is presented by Moët & Chandon, who has stood for celebrations for over 275 years. As we examine the ingredients of some pretty unforgettable creative careers, we're grateful for the support of the world's most loved champagne and for their encouragement to celebrate life's memorable moments. As a student of film, as much as a filmmaker, I'm sure you've watched a zillion space movies. What did you learn to do or what not to do from watching so many space movies?
Once we sort of made this decision here to try to really be faithful to a documentary perspective as much as possible, and to really try to emulate, in many instances, the archival footage, you know, a lot of other possibilities fall by the wayside. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, you know, new opportunities arise, and you're trying to sort of find ways to inject your own personality into the language. And I think that kind of dictated a little bit what I was watching and what I wouldn't watch, what I'd purposefully avoid watching.
What did you purposely avoid watching?
Well, I actually purposely avoided watching almost any movie about space once I really started working on this movie.
No Apollo 13.
No, I mean, these were all movies that I had, of course, either seen many times before or would make a point of rewatching early on in the process. But as soon as you start to feel the shoot date approaching, as soon as prep started really beginning, Linus and I, we made a habit of screening Prince for the for the crew every week during prep, all the way leading up to the shoot date, and very intentionally they were never space movies. I wanted to try to shake people out of conventional space film language. As great as that stuff can be, I wanted them to try to just think outside the box and shoot space as though they're shooting, you know, the D-Day landing and Saving Private Ryan, or shoot space as though they're shooting, a car chase in The French Connection, or you know, shoot space as though they're shooting Under the Water in Das Boot, you know, like those were, and then shoot the family dynamics, you know, and things on the ground, not like, not like in the way that maybe they're used to seeing 60s period pieces, but to shoot them like a Maisel's Brothers documentary or a Frederick Weissman documentary, or you know, maybe taking a left turn like a Bergman family chamber piece, you know, just trying in a way to cast a net in such a way that I find it actually hard sometimes to be inspired by stuff that's literally about the same subject matter, because you wind up just being afraid of replicating and duplicating. So when we were trying to figure out how to shoot NASA machinery, we decided to watch Red Desert, you know, by Antonioni, when we were trying to figure out how to sort of find a language for the grief and the sort of distance between people in the family that Neil and Janet would be going through. We watched, Cries and Whispers when we were trying to figure out how to shoot the space capsules, things like that. We watched Saving Private Ryan or Das Boot. So
That, just letting yourself though be influenced by other things too.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that are different.
And hopefully trying to let opposite things speak to each other. It was sort of what I liked about doing Whiplash from the get-go, was kind of, can you shoot a jazz concert like a car chase or like a boxing match? And here it was, you know, can you shoot a space launch like a battle scene? Can you shoot the moon like a, you know, 1920s ghost movie? You know, can you just find in, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes it inspires you, and sometimes it literally goes in one ear and out the other, but it's always in service of trying to craft what your own language is going to be so you're not duplicating.
Well, when I saw the film, I thought less about other space movies and more about the work of the artist Tom Sachs. Do you know his NASA-obsessed work?
Oh, very tangentially. I don't know his work very well.
Oh, it's great. It's less about the dream and wonder of space and more about the impossibly human scrappiness of it.
Yes.
So that you see, you know, the ingenuity of the people behind it, the fact that everything's put together by scotch tape.
Yep.
It seems like you wanted to make the Tom Sachs version of a space movie where you see some of the scotch tape.
Yeah. Kind of the garage rock band version of going to space where you, but in a way, I mean, it's kind of, it almost feels like that's also, to me, like the more honest version of it, because you look at something like the LEM in person, you know, or one of the capsules or Mission Control at that time. And it's just, you can't help but, I think, be sort of stunned by how scotch tape-esque it feels. I mean, these things look like they were built for science fairs, or like, literally by hand in a garage. And it just, I find it endlessly shocking and stunning that some of these things actually made it into space and back.
Well, even Mission Control Houston, in your movie, it looks different from any other movie I've ever seen. It looks less opulent. It looks less stylized. It looks almost, it looks smaller. And I wondered if you had, or your production designers had, like, gone to Houston, studied it, tried to make it a little bit more, it felt a little, like all the computer screens are tiny and downscaled and prehistoric.
Yeah.
It felt, maybe more honest, but was that a concerted effort?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it was also the sort of, on the one hand, there's kind of trying to make the capsules dirtier and things like that, that I think help in many ways the suspense. You feel more terrified when you look at these things. But then there's also the kind of workaday life at NASA, the deglamorization, I guess, of what we've tended to glamorize and romanticize. I remember going to NASA myself and walking down those hallways, and it's, they're government buildings, and you sort of forget that. Government font, that sort of very kind of standardized government font on every door, the fluorescent lighting, the small tightness of the architecture, the slightly dirty carpeting, it's the opposite of glamour. And and so it felt like that was something to try to lean into. And so we talked a lot about, you know, dirtying things up, knowing that the camera is also going to clean. The camera itself just naturally, it's why so many period films feel too sparkly and new.
Because the camera already cleans up.
Winds up, you know, erasing a lot of the little sort of nitty gritty that you try to add onto it. So you actually have to kind of go a little further. And so everything from coffee stains to cigarette, you know, marks to, you know, crumbs of food to, you know, a little bit of grease under the knobs or dirt under fingernails to stains on people's shirts. I mean, all that stuff, you know, on its own can be very tiny and maybe not even noticeable. But if you do enough of it and you do it in a way that's kind of concerted throughout and it just is baked into the overall look, and it's not just a production design thing, it's also costumes very much. Mary Zoffrey's, you know, was really great and adamant about just making every costume feel lived in. Sweat stains, you know, little drips from the cigarette butts.
You definitely see some sweat stains in there.
For sure. And that we loved all that stuff. We wanted to just indulge in all of that, revel in all of that. This was not glamorous work. These were people working insane hours for not a lot of money. I think that's actually part of what's heroic about what they did.
Well, there's you de-glamorize it, but there is also the mission itself is just huge. There's no doubting that. And I would think that a lot of directors would have been daunted by that, just by it's, you know, there are a few things sort of more legendary and burnished in legend than the landing on the moon.
Well, I was very daunted.
But I was going to say, what daunted you about this?
I assure you.
What daunted you about this? Was it the technical stuff, or was it...
Yeah, how do you make an audience feel like it felt like the whole movie was going to live or die on whether an audience actually felt like they themselves were going on these missions. Mm-hmm. You know, it felt like if we couldn't really give an audience that truly immersive experience, then we weren't, you know, going back to the idea of adding something new to the art form, to the equation, we weren't really going to be putting our stamp on it. But it's kind of a tough thing. It's like, okay, we've got to do, you know, these effects and recreate these things that in many cases are recreations of things that people know, that people have seen. You know, they've seen the real version of. So you can't just wing what the moon looks like, at least the part of moon that the Apollo 11, you know, Lem landed on. And you have to find a way to adapt your own capabilities to reality at every juncture.
There's one thing that's just kind of amazing to me is that sound is so important in this movie. When they climb aboard Gemini 8, they scan the vessel, and you can feel and hear every bolt creaking against the pressure. Later inside the Eagle, before Armstrong and Aldrin land on the moon, there are these ominous creaks and whooshes and warbles, and then the eerie silence of the moon. How did you know what the inside of a rocket sounded like, or what the moon sounded like?
Well, yeah, obviously I don't really know. That's the dirty secret.
But
here.
I did believe you.
But you kind of want people to, a lot of it is trying to find ways to differentiate, I guess, what you're doing, and this applies to sound a lot, in such a way that where the audience instinctively feels they can buy what they're hearing or seeing, not despite it being different from what they're used to, but because it's different than what they're used to. And so I think, you know, we talked, you know, my sound team and I talked a lot about how to achieve that. You know, they started by trying to get as close to the real versions as possible. So they, you know, they went in the actual capsules when they could and sort of, you know, were able to sometimes flick switches and, you know, get those sounds. They took actual moon suits and earlier astronaut suits and would stick mics in the helmet and in the various valves to see what oxygen sounded like going through them, or cooling tubes, or, you know, even just the creases of gloves, what those things sounded like. They went to launches, not Saturn V launches, obviously, but they went to Falcon X launches. So they sort of went all over to try to just collect a repertoire of, I guess, what you'd say, what you call real sounds.
Well, that's the documentary aspiration.
That's the documentary aspiration. But then you have that, and then you have to go the extra mile, I think, in order to actually make an audience feel like they're there. Because the sound itself, if it's purely just sort of a two-dimensional documentary reality, can still feel a little bit removed from us. And so occasionally, I think you want to, I'm a big believer in trying to work outside the box to heighten emotionally certain things where you're going after emotional reality, if not literal reality. And I think I was always so inspired as like a kid, you know, realizing that this weird sound I was hearing that was getting under my skin during one of the Raging Bull boxing matches were actually the sound of bulls, yeah. you know, and animals. And I just thought, wow, that's crazy. That's cool. And so Ai Ling Lee, the sound effects designer in this movie, you know, wound up doing similar stuff. There's during some of those launches, you know, you're hearing horses and lions roaring and rhinoceroses and birds and wolves. You're also hearing warfare, you know, sounds of warfare, yeah. guns, mortar shells. But they're always baked in such a way where I'd say they're kind of just adding an interpretive layer on top of the actual authentic documentary sound.
Last thing, each of these critical moments of the mission have these challenges, and not the least of which is the heroic expectations we have of the actual moon landing. And I don't just mean the MTV flag moment of it all, which isn't there. I mean the genuine awesomeness of the achievement. When Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin land on the moon, it felt to me more poetic than triumphant. Mm-hmm. Everything's seen through the reflections on their visors. You see their human shadows of the moon as much as the moon itself. And that makes it more meditative, more odd than mm-hmm. awesome. Can you tell me about the artistic decision to portray it that way?
Well, it felt also like with the story we were telling that final moonwalk couldn't help but be, you know, sort of bitter and sweet at the same time. Sweet, obviously, because of the triumph of the accomplishment, and because, of course, it's one of the great accomplishments in history. But bitter in the sense that it came at such a high cost and with such a high price on it. And you know, in those final moments of Neil on the moon, by that point, he's someone who has lost a good number of the people he's loved throughout his life. And I think one thing that always spoke to me about the moon, you know, especially looking at actual photography of it, is how deathly it really is. It really is a land of the dead. It's the closest that history has ever gotten to the myth of Orpheus going into Hades to fetch Eurydice, literally human beings going beyond where mortals are allowed to go and glimpsing another side. And so I think that I just find that endlessly moving, that idea. And so finding a balance, I guess, where we were going to, you know, do justice to the history that's so meaningful to so many people of what was accomplished and of those first steps on the moon, while at the same time trying to give you a glimpse, hopefully, of what, you know, you wouldn't have known or been able to experience otherwise, of what Neil might have been feeling, of what that mixture of bitter and sweet sentiments might have been. The moment of looking back at Earth once you're on the moon, you know, it's this ironic thing of, you know, almost that you go to the edge of outer space in order to think about home, you know, in order to get a perspective on home. I think those things wound up being sort of the key themes we wanted to play with there.
Yeah, it's a really, really affecting scene. And it's a hell of a way to end the movie. Although the movie actually ends in silence, which I thought was a great decision to sort of end it on something that is bigger than words.
Yeah, and I guess all, I mean, you talk about the sort of intimacy and versus, you know, what's the opposite of intimacy? Epicness.
Yeah.
It felt like
epic ambition.
Right. it felt like in many ways it would be sort of both ironic and fitting to close the movie on such a sort of quiet moment where two people are physically almost as close as they've ever been, but of course, you know, in some ways emotionally are as far away as they've ever been. And this kind of inability to bridge that gap, but that attempt to bridge the gap, just the sort of unspoken, you know, currents of that felt like it wasn't the ending that was originally in the script, and it was an ending that sort of just kind of pronounced itself when we were editing. Just sort of made itself very clear that this had to be how it closed.
I can't thank you enough, Damien Chazelle, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
First Man is out October 12th. Damien will also be in the next issue of GQ. And hey, if you like what you're hearing, please subscribe and even rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. Thanks.